Doug R. from Tahunga.
Hi, everybody. My name is Doug Rowell. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Hey,
I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I say that is, I don't know, to piss off the newcomers, I guess. I don't know if it did. When I was new, I remember I heard somebody say, I'm a grateful alcoholic, and I thought, well, you're a moron. You're at that point in my life, I was willing to admit that I was an alcoholic, but I was not any too happy about it. And anybody who was happy about it just didn't have a life. The fact is, today, I'm absolutely positive my life today is better because I'm an alcoholic than it would have been if I hadn't been an alcoholic. And there's no way to prove that, but I'm the only alcoholic in my immediate family, and I would rather be me than any of them. That's sometimes misinterpreted if I say that. Did everybody else hear that? Because I did some drugs too. Every once in a while, I'll just go, woo, like. The family that I come from is a middle class, hardworking, loving, happy, musical family, Orange County. I'm the oldest of four kids, the only boy, the only alcoholic in the family, as far as I know. I had to really work at it to become an alcoholic. You know, when I finally got sober, it seemed like it was really important to find out why I'm an alcoholic. I don't know, a lot of us do that. It's a totally useless piece of information. But it's just, I want to know, you know, because I had guys that I drank with who would just drink like, just exactly like me, and then they'd stop and go home, or stop and go to work or something, you know, and we'd be at lunch and drinking, and then you want another beer? No, man, I got to go back to work. I couldn't imagine what those two things had to do with each other. Working with my friend Barney, we're working on his scooter and on his motorcycle, and I said, Barney, you want a shot of whiskey? He goes, no, I got to ride this thing, man. You know, I'm like, but the alcohol means something different to most of the people in the world than it did to my family. But when I discovered I was an alcoholic, and I finally got sober. I didn't get sober right away after I found out I was an alcoholic and admitted I was an alcoholic, but I'll tell you about that. But when I finally did, and I'm looking for how come I'm an alcoholic, because I didn't start drinking too young. I didn't have a drink till I was 18 years old, so I didn't care about drinking. The guys I went to high school with who drank, it just didn't, there was nothing attractive about it to me, and I ended up being the designated driver a lot. And what happened was my friend Morris said to me, I had this girlfriend, and we would go, you know, we're in high school, we're seniors in high school, he said, we'd go and park by the railroad tracks and, you know, make out. And my friend Morris said, look, if you want to get a home run with this girl, because we used to use these baseball terms, you know, there was first base and second base and third base, and then, of course, the home run. And I don't think they do that anymore. And I'm glad they don't, because there's not enough bases, really. Not that I don't remember where the bases are anywhere, really. I can guess. I probably guess accurately, but I remember home run. A home run was like, that's what I was looking for. Morris said, if you want to get a home run with this girl, you're going to have to get her drunk. And I heard that. And so so I went and stole a quart of Rainier Ale, which seemed like it was the national beverage of Garden Grove, where I grew up. So we went and parked where we had parked many times before after a date. But this time I got my ammunition. You know, I was like, this quarter Rainier Ale. And I didn't really care about drinking. I still didn't. I would have been happy to say, here, drink this and let me know when you're ready. But it seemed rude. And I, you know, I'm a polite young guy. So I opened it and I had a little pull on it. I gave it to her and she had a drink and we passed it back and forth and laughed and we got kind of giddy. And without going into any details, it turned out Morris was right. This was the first time I ever had an alcohol buzz and the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness. So I don't remember the commitment exactly, but I know at some point in that evening I said, I'm going to do both of these things much as I can the rest of my life. And so I didn't start drinking too young. I was 18. I was virtually a man. And I don't come from an alcoholic family, as I told you. But once I got sober and I'm looking for how did I end up an alcoholic? You know, my dad is the kind of guy who would buy a six-pack of beer on a Saturday and drink one and put five in the refrigerator and not remember if he had beer. You know what I'm saying? If somebody would come over, hey, Ed, you got any beer? I don't know. I'll look and see. And I'm like 8 years old. I'm like, Dad, Saturday you bought six. You drank one. There's five in the fridge. My dad was an engineer. It's like, are you a mathematician or what? Six minus one, just five. You got to move them to get the lettuce out. But it just wasn't important to him. But my mother may be an alcoholic. You can't tell because she won't drink. And it's hard to tell, you know, they won't drink. And so she, after I got sober and I'm looking for what's the underlying cause, I said, Mom, why don't you drink? And she said, why do you care? I said, well, are you an alcoholic? She said, am I? You're the alcoholic. Am I an alcoholic? Have you ever seen me take a drink, ever? No, but I know hundreds of alcoholics who don't drink, so why don't you drink? She said, why do you care? I said, well, okay, I'll tell you. It may be your fault I'm a drunk. There's such a thing as a genetic predisposition, Mom. So, what do you think? She said, you're crazier than anybody thinks you are. And she said, I'll tell you the truth. When I was young, I drank with friends. Every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious, so I stopped. I don't do it anymore. I said, you got to drink through that, Mom. You know, my mother doesn't have the tenacity to make this program. You got to stick with this thing. I figure the promised land lies beyond sick, stupid, and obnoxious. I figure if I get sick, stupid, and obnoxious behind some booze, not even my problem, it's your problem. So I don't know. My sister, Yvonne, my oldest sister, she moved to Kansas to go to college, and then she just got married there, and she stayed in Kansas. So I went to visit her when I was about 5 years sober, and she was real active in her church. And I would go to meetings in Wichita. I'd get up in the morning and go into Wichita and go to a meeting, and I'd come back. So we start talking about alcoholism, and I said, do you ever drink? I mean, do you just not drink because like your church? And she goes, no, I'll have a glass of wine at midnight on New Year's. I said, every New Year's? You know, they call that pattern drinking, Yvonne. But they get defensive, you know, if you really talk to them about their drinking. Well, not every New Year, she said. I said, really? You skip a year? Like, why would you do that? Why would you skip your annual glass of wine? She said, I don't know. I mean, it's New Year's, Doug. There's guns going off outside. The dogs are barking. The kids are running around. Sometimes I just forget. there's a concept I just cannot get a handle on. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I want you to think about it. If Bill Wilson and God came to you in a vision and said, you're doing very well in AA, and we decided you could have a glass of wine at midnight on New Year's, and you were dumb enough to accept those terms, I will ask for a show of hands. How many people would forget your annual glass of wine, you know? I would be sharpening the corkscrew at Thanksgiving dinner. So I don't know why I'm an alcoholic, and like I said, it's a useless piece of information. There used to be a Catholic priest in Alabama named Father Hillary, was an alcoholic, and he was well known for saying, it don't matter how the jackass got in the ditch, Lim, get him out. And that's what we do here, we get him out. And so I didn't come to AA to quit drinking. I just came to see what it was. I had a friend who had gotten sober in AA. She was, Teddy was fun to drink with. She was a real fun party girl, but she was also crazy and dangerous. So you could get in trouble drinking with her, but that's part of the fun part of it. You don't know what's going to happen. And so when Teddy stopped, but she was getting a little out of hand, quite out of hand. And so I was glad when she got sober. And I saw a transformation in her that I couldn't believe. Within a few short months, she would show up. I mean, she'd be where she said she was going to be when she said she was going to be there, dressed appropriately, and speaking in whole sentences. Teddy had been with me when we were skiing up at Mammoth, and I skied off a cliff drunk, and every time you say it that way, it sounds like an accident. Oh no, 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 no! It was right after the Winter Olympics, and there was this cliff that when you come down from this one run on lift 7, you had to make a hard left to go around the trail, or you could go off the cliff. So I went around it a couple of times. It was okay, but it's only about a 25-foot cliff, so. One day, one of the runs, I just came down and went sailing off like that because I had seen the guys in the Winter Olympics jump like, I don't know, 70 meters or whatever they jump. So 25 feet just didn't seem. But you know, when you watch those guys, every one of them, regardless of what their style or where they come from, what country they're, they always lean way over the front of their skis. That's the one thing they all do. And I always thought they did that for show. No, no. It turns out if you don't do that, your skis will go straight up in the air as soon as you're airborne, and then you're heading for the planet with the skis on top and head on the bottom, which you'll never read an unweighting exercise in Ski Magazine, how to come down with your skis on top and your head on the bottom. It's just not recommended. But I landed 25 feet below that cliff upside down and broke my shoulder, and the ski patrol had to take me down and down the hill, and my sister was with us. She had to drive my van back, and they put me in the hospital, and I was out of work for 6 weeks while they operated on my shoulder, and I healed and got back from that operation and got back to work, and I was back to work maybe a couple of months if that. And somebody had a party that lasted all night long, and in the morning, most of the people had left, but there was just a handful of us left. And the woman that owned the house said, if somebody would take me to the store and get some eggs, I'll make breakfast. So I said, I'll do it. So my Harley was parked across the driveway. Nobody could get out anyway. So we got on my Harley and we started to go. I don't know why I thought Harleys and eggs was a good idea. But anyway, we started to go to the store. And it was an April morning. You know, April in Southern California, it's not hot. It's not cold. It's brisk. Especially right at sunrise, and the sun was just creeping over the horizon, like that, just starting to light up the sky, and the air was brisk, and it was before the helmet law, so our hair is flying in the air. We had that Harley rumble going, and there's no traffic, you know, and it just was so sexy. We both had the same idea, you know, what would be beautiful, to make love in the great outdoors. And I don't know if you're familiar with downtown Burbank, but it's not a great lot of lovemaking venues, outdoor lovemaking venues. We found a four-story parking structure. And that seemed like that would do it. You know, we're up where nobody can see us from the street, and we got the whole thing to ourselves, but the gate was locked. Because it's just, you know, it's sunrise. It's not, nothing's happening yet in the office buildings. And so we went around to the fire escape and went up, parked the bike, went up the fire escape, and the fire escape door is locked. I'm a figure-outer. I said, this fire escape door has to be unlocked from the inside. I'm going over the wall, open it from the inside, we'll have the whole thing to ourselves. So I jumped up, I got the wall, excuse me, and I'm trying. It wasn't as easy getting over the wall as I thought it was going to be. It was a little thicker than it wasn't like this. It was like this, and so I'm swinging back and forth and trying. I know I'm going to figure out some way because I always, almost always do. And this is one of the almost times, and it so it turned out. I remember seeing this building going, and I thought the building's going up. No, no, this is a stationary building. I'm falling, and so. I fell 54 feet and landed on my feet, but my knees buckled, and my foot, I kicked myself in the ass is what happened, and broke my pelvis in two places and snapped the heel bone off my right foot and shoved it through my foot like a bowling ball, and it was, I didn't walk away from that one, but here's the deal. God has always been with me, whether I recognize it or not. This was the parking structure of St. Joseph's Hospital. So so the gal was with me, ran in the ER, and she said, hey, my friend just fell off your parking lot, and it broke him. He's the one crumpled up at the bottom of the fire escape there. And so they got an ambulance to drive me across the lawn, and then they admitted me, and I was in the hospital for 10 days while they tried to figure out my foot. If you look at the end of your own leg and you see this ball, it was a ball because it didn't break the skin. It just crunched all these bones and my foot swelled up like a ball with toes in it. And it's an awful thing to look at the end of your own leg. And it was so many colors, green and orange and blue and black and yellow. And it just goes, this is bad. This is not good at all. And so they finally, after I was in there 10 days, they did about 8 hours of surgery and manipulate and a pin and x-ray and all that, and I got out of there. It took me 5 months to learn to walk without crutches or a cane or something, and I finally got back to work. And so Teddy, my friend Teddy, who was sober now, was with me on both of those experiences. So when she would talk to me, and I'd say, God, Teddy, you look so good. She'd say, well, thank you, I'm sober. Yeah, I know, you're sober. Yeah, I'm going to AA. Yeah, I get that. That's great. I'm so happy for you. Yeah, you know, my sponsor says, I don't care what your sponsor says, Ted. I'd say things to you like, oh, I got to get down to the cleaners and get my suit out before they close. Is that the one on Foothill? I go to a meeting right across the street from there. I don't care where your meetings are. I don't care what your sponsor says. I don't care what's in your book. Ted, let me tell you something. If I ever see alcohol interfering with my life, I probably will go to AA. And she had kind of the same reaction you just had, you know, except she just stared at me. She said, Doug, what would you call interference? Brain death? And I said, I see where you're going with this, but I don't think accidents should count, you know. I mean, really, it's drunk or sober, you fall off a four-story building and you're going to get hurt, you know. She said, get hurt. It took you 5 months to learn to walk. You had a 0.40 blood alcohol level. Yeah, I know, but still, you're getting alcoholism mixed up with gravity. And and so she just gave up on me. She went away. But all that week, every time I'd have, you know, a little quiet moment, and little flashes come back to you of things, I'd picture Teddy's face going, what would you call interference, Doug? Brain death? And I started thinking about it seriously. Any one of those accidents I just told you about, a lot of them I didn't tell you about, any one of them could have ended in brain death. And I also realized the next one might end in brain death, and there will be a next one. There's always a next one. I was frequently getting hurt drunk. And It's possible if I keep drinking, I could end up in a bed or a wheelchair for the rest of my life, and not able to feed myself or go to the bathroom by myself and know it. And that scared me. It scared me so bad I rushed right down to AA 3 years later. And I went to my first meeting. It was a meeting at a subterranean community room at Valley Presbyterian Hospital in Van Nuys. And it was somebody told me, if you want to check out AA, go to a big speaker meeting. They'll leave you alone. So this is about 200 people who went to this meeting. And I had heard about it, but I'd never been there, of course. I hadn't been to a meeting. And I didn't know what time it started, and I didn't know how to find out. So I got there about 6:30, and the meeting started at 8:30, so I'm way early. And I go in, and I'm watching people set up chairs, and they're hugging and laughing. Everybody seems so happy, and I'm like, oh, happy guys. And so they're making coffee, you know, and setting up literature, and I'm just leaning against the wall. Me and this other guy. There's another guy on the other side of the double doors. We're both standing there with our arms crossed, looking irritated. And everybody else is laughing and talking, setting up chairs and making coffee. Two of us are I thought, well, we are the cool section. We were so cool, we didn't even talk to each other. And people didn't leave me alone. It's a friend of mine that told me, go to a big speaker meeting, they'll leave you alone. That's a lie. We don't stay sober leaving new people alone. That's just not how this thing works. So people would come up to me and go, hi, you're new, right? And I'd say, no, I'm not. So a lot of them would be embarrassed, you know, maybe I met them last week or something, they'd go away. Now, this guy, Hank, came up to me and he said, hey, you're new. I said, no, I'm not. And he said, oh, I haven't seen you here before. What's your name? He said, my name's Doug. And I've never been here before. That's why you haven't seen me here before. Oh, that's what we mean by new, man. You're new, like you've never been here before. I said, okay, I'm new, like I've never been here before, but I'm not new, like a new member, okay? I'm not some desperate alcoholic coming here, oh, save me, help me, I'm drowning in alcohol. That's not me, man. You know, that's just not who I am. I'm here checking it out. I'm observing. You know what I'm saying? I'm auditing the class, pal. You know what I'm saying? Understand? I'm not here begging for your help, so don't give me your number. Don't ask for mine. Don't put me on your little roster or whatever you guys do. You know, I'm over here just standing over here minding my own business. You might try that sometime, you know, and see how that works for you. And I said, you know, I'm not a joiner, man. That's just not who I am. I'm a loner, I'm an outlaw, I'm a desperado, okay? A misfit. I never fit any place in my life. I didn't fit in school. I don't fit in the workplace. I barely fit in my own damn family. I'm certainly not gonna fit here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hug, hug, laugh, laugh. Isn't it good we're not drinking? No, I like drinking. I drank on the way here, you know? I certainly plan to drink on the way home, so I don't think I'm your target market, okay? He goes, I like you. You're gonna fit right in. I thought I was pretty articulate with that, you know, but I absolutely understand what he means now. But at the time, I thought maybe English isn't his first language. We were there for a while, me and this other cool guy, just like, you know, thumbs up to each other, not talking to each other. And I saw people go up and talk to him. So they started the meeting. Somebody said, there's some chairs over there if you want to sit down. You know what? I'm a figure outer. I've been watching people come in. They put down a coat, put down a purse, put down keys. And no keys, no coat, no purse. That seat's available. I get it. I'm a figure outer. But the thing is, I may not be able to stay for your whole meeting, so I'm just going to stand back here. I'm cool standing up through the whole thing. If I have to leave, I don't want to cause a big scene. Now, today, if somebody said I might have to leave before the meeting's over, I would think, oh, maybe he's going to get a text or a call or something. Nobody had cell phones in 1986. I mean, they had mobile phones, but they were expensive and they were big. They were briefcases. Surgeons had them, you know, producers had them. I didn't have one. I didn't even have a pager. Some people had pagers. I didn't have a pager. I didn't need a pager. Nobody wanted to contact me. What the hell I need a pager for? But what I had was a garage door opener with a belt clip on it, you know. and I got it for 75 cents at the Goodwill. So it looked like I was important enough to have a pager, you know, and yet it would never bother me. So it was really cool. I just walk around looking halfway important, you know, and then if I'm in the middle of a conversation and my drink alarm goes off, you know, your head will say, "What are you doing? Get out of here. Go get a drink." I can go, "Oh, I got to get this. I'll be right back," you know. And it's great unless somebody says, "What is that? It looks like my garage door opener." Yeah, it is. It's a combination garage door opener, pager, and TV remote. It's the latest, coolest thing. I got one. And so, because people, I would call somebody, hey, it's Doug. Are you going to be home? Because I'm going to come over and visit you. No, we're not, Doug. We're just walking out the door. You know, I don't know. How long we'll be gone? Long time, though. Don't come over here. Okay. Love you, Mom. And so me and this other cool guy are standing back at the back of the room, and they start the meeting, and people read stuff, you know, like we did tonight, you know, the steps and the traditions and all that stuff. I didn't know any. As a matter of fact, I was looking for the steps. I had heard of the 12 steps, but I didn't realize in chapter 5 that was read that the steps were in there. I don't know what I thought I heard. I heard honesty. People talking about honesty, you know, rigorous honesty. It's like, shut up. I don't want to hear that. Yeah, honestly, if you can get sober, if you're honest, you know, and even people who have grave emotional and mental disorders can get sober. Crazy people can get sober if they're honest, if they're rigorously honest. Shut up. And but because honesty, it's not my default mechanism. You know what I mean? It's just not. It's not where I go automatically. I'm better, much better at it today, sober for 28 years than I was at the time. But before I got sober, the most honest thing I ever said was my first wife said to me, "All right, Doug, I want the truth. Did you sleep with my sister?" I said, "Not a wink." And and in sobriety, I'm basically honest in sobriety, but sometimes it's appropriate to lie. A waiter says to me, "Sir, would you like a cocktail before dinner?" I lie to the waiter. I say, "No, thank you." Instead of saying, "You know, there's a part of my heart, son, that would like a cocktail more than I'd like my next damn breath." but I have this illness, you know, it's a disease, it's a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy and spiritual bankruptcy. I don't think you want that in your nice restaurant, do you? So I don't have to go there. I can say just no thank you, you know, and not make the waiter be afraid to come back to the table. If you're new in here and you're wondering about this rigorous honesty thing, wear it like a loose garment. Like, it doesn't mean if you go home and your wife says, "Honey, does this dress make me look fat?" That's not the time for rigorous honesty, you know. "No, baby, I think it's the Haagen-Dazs," you know. The dress looked fine on the hanger, but let's... let's go try it on a skinny blonde next door. I mean, if it makes her look fat, then it's the dress. But then you put that spoon down for a couple of weeks, you look... See, that's rigorous stupidity. You don't have to do that. So, just trying to help. So, but I know somebody spoke at that meeting. There was a speaker, because it was a speaker meeting. I can't tell you if the speaker was a man or a woman, let alone what he or she said. So, every once in a while when I do this... And a lot of times they want to treat you real like you're real special because you're the speaker, you know. And I remember, I'm just an AA member, you know. I'm just like the coffee maker, only not as important. And because I don't remember if the speaker at my first meeting was a man or a woman, let alone what he or she said. I remember that they had three different kinds of coffee. I remember this guy, Hank, talking to me. I remember that they had a birthday. Secretary said, we have a birthday tonight for Ruth for 18 years. I thought, well, that's cool. They celebrate people's birthdays. So I'm looking around for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny honey, you know, and it's a meeting sort of like this, where they didn't have like a pulpit, but they had a proscenium stage, and you had to go upstairs to get to it, and that's where the podium was and everything, and Ruth is walking. She's the only person standing up and walking towards the stage, so I know that's Ruth. Ruth was 50 if she was a day, and I thought, damn, if she's 18, she should stop drinking tonight. But, and she didn't look bad. She looked great for 50. She just a little whip for a teenager. And so I think, oh, I get it. Okay, I get it. This is AA. They don't drink here. Nobody drinks. Ruth hasn't had a drink in 18 years. Happy birthday, Ruth. I get it. Oh, my God, I cued the choir. You know, I didn't know you sang. And I've been to some meetings in this area where they sing. I don't know if you do that here, but some they do. And in the valley, they do all over. They'd sing, like, 400 people or 200 people started singing Happy Birthday in four different keys at the same time. I'm a musician. I've been a musician for a long time. I play guitar. I've worked professionally as a musician. Picking up bad singing is not a difficult call for me. This was horrible singing. 200 people singing Happy Birthday at the same time, but in four different keys, and many were not even committed to the key they started in. I'm like, oh my God, there's a piano on stage. There's a piano on stage with a sheet over it. And I believe to this day that any group of 200 Americans, somebody in that group can fake Happy Birthday on the piano. It's not a hard, it's a three-chord song, GCD. And I'm a guitar player, and I could do it. So somebody had piano lessons, and I thought, maybe I should do it. Get everybody in the same key, be kind of a hero, you know, at my first meeting, and run up there and grab that sheet off the piano. Here I come to save the day, you know, and just get everybody in the same key. And then it occurred to me that hero thing doesn't always work out like I think it's going to. Why don't you just shut up? It's a short song. So I did. Shut up, and they keep coming back. And I'm like, oh, jeez. And Ruth blows out the candles, and she gets up to the podium. She says, my name is Ruth, and I'm an alcoholic. And, of course, everybody goes, hi, Ruth! And I'm like, jeez. It seemed like kindergarten stuff to me, you know. My friend Scott R. used to say, this is some level of lameness I never knew was available to me. And so Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years of sobriety, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. Well, I didn't know that you could go to a meeting every day, let alone that somebody would do it for 18 years. I mean, it was a culture shock. I looked over at the other cool guy, and I realized he's not cool. He's a member. I don't know why he's standing. Maybe he's got the newcomer catcher commitment or something, but I know he's a member because he's now heading over to me, you know, with his hand out like we do, and with that sunbeam for Jesus smile. Takes my hand in both hands, and he says, hey, tell you what, you stay sober a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. Yep, that's what he said. He said, if I don't drink for a year, I get a cake. I was so shocked I couldn't even make fun of him. Because to me it seemed like if you don't drink for a year, you ought to get a car, you know? Really, a cake? And so I said, you know, I'm not much of a pastry eater. If I wanted a cake, I'd just stop at Safeway on the way home. I think they're like $5, you know. Yeah, or I could not drink for a year. Let me see. Because I know I'm going to drink on the way home. And I don't know anything about this guy, really. I kind of felt like he was son of a brother or something, but we're very different. I know he values cake more than I do. And we probably don't have the same relationship with ethyl alcohol. At one point during that meeting, the secretary held up this book. And she said, "This is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic text of our program. It's the only authority on AA," she said. "If you don't have a book, if you're new tonight, please don't leave without this book. We want you to have it. And we'll make very liberal credit arrangements." I thought, okay, well, I'll steal that book. She said, "We'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week until you get back on your feet." So now, if I steal the book, you're going to think I'm not on my feet. You're going to think I'm homeless, like I can't afford a book. It's a hardcover book. It's probably $20-25. Now I have to buy the book. I don't know if you understand that, but like I have my pride. I will steal from you, but I won't accept your damn charity, you know. And so now I got to wait till the end of the meeting for sure. And I got to go up to her and say, "Excuse me, ma'am, can I buy one of your books?" She said, "Oh, the big book?" Yeah, the big book. Yeah, I've seen bigger. "How much is that big book?" She said, it's $4.65. Do you have it?" $4.65 for a hardcover book? "Yeah, I think I can handle that. Here's a five. Keep the change." "No, I'll get your change." No, I'm serious. I'm going to buy that $4.65 book for $5 and keep that change and use it to help a drunk because I'm on my feet, okay? So now I got my book and I stopped on the way home and I got a fifth of whiskey and I got home and I sat down, poured three fingers of whiskey, and I sat down to read this book. I didn't stay up all night studying the big book. That didn't happen. Turns out I have the ability to look at the title of a chapter, almost any book, and pretty much know everything in the chapter. I don't know. It's just a gift that I have. And so some of it I didn't bother with. The doctor's opinion, I've had doctor's opinions. "Doug, you really need to cut down on your drinking." "Okay, Doc, I'll start on that tomorrow." So I got into the basic meat of the program. Chapter 1, Bill's story. Who cares? Chapter 2, there's a solution. That's a sales pitch. "Young man, there's a solution to your problem. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams." Great. Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. That sounds promising. It sounds like it could actually be the most boring piece of literature in the English language. So I'm going to save that till I'm tweaking some night, you know, feel like I got toothpicks in my eyelids and more about alcoholism. So I'm saving that one. I'm already up to chapter 4. I've already read a word. Chapter 4 is called We Agnostics. That got my attention. Because when I walked into my first meeting, I nobody ever told me this, but I had a belief that I was going to walk into a room full of alcoholics, people who drank like I did and don't drink anymore and were atheists and agnostics. And the reason I thought that is because my grandmother, who was a drunk, found Jesus and got sober and dedicated her life to Christ and became a Pentecostal minister. She opened a Skid Row mission on Beacon Street in San Pedro. If you know that area, especially in the 50s when she was there, now there's like Ports of Call and different things, there's recovery places around there on Beacon Street. But in the 50s, when my grandmother opened her little mission, people got killed on Beacon Street after dark. And it was all full of saloons and liquor stores and shooting galleries and my grandma and hawk shops and my grandmother's little White Dove Pentecostal mission. My grandmother hated AA. And I always thought she hated it because there was no God here. But after coming here, you don't have to be in AA for 5 minutes before you hear power greater than yourself, my higher power, humbly asked him with a capital H, admitted to God, prayed to God, told God, oh my God, God, the last house on the block is Sunday school. I was so done. I was so disappointed. My last hope was Alcoholics Anonymous. If I ever really wanted to quit drinking, and it's all about God. It's all this God saw. It's just, but I was so disappointed. But now I'm reading this book the secretary had said was the only authority, and it's got this chapter 4, We Agnostics. So I've told him, I'm a figure outer. This is the chapter, How the Smart People Stay Sober Without God. So good. So I poured another 3 fingers of whiskey and I read that whole chapter all the way through. And I got done and I thought, I have absolutely no idea what I just read. Because it's not saying what I'm looking for. The information I'm looking for is not in there. As a matter of fact, in the first paragraph, it says, if you honestly want to, you find you can't quit drinking entirely, or once you start, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. And if this be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. That's pretty clear. But not for me, because I'm like, yeah, where's the smart people stay sober without God? So I read this chapter 3 times that night with a glass of whiskey in between each one, trying to figure out what I missed in there, how the smart people stay sober without God. Chapter 4, I've heard people that are more knowledgeable about spiritual literature than I am say, maybe the most important piece of spiritual literature in the English language in the 20th century is Chapter 4, We Agnostics in the Big Book. I can't say if that's true or not because I'm no expert on spiritual literature, but it's a remarkable chapter, and a lot of people don't read it because they go, yeah, I'm not an agnostic, and they skip right over it. Yeah, I'm not a wife. Yeah, I'm not an employer. Skip over all this stuff. Anyway, third time I'm reading through this thing, a sentence jumped off the page at me. It says, "We found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek Him." I had read it several times by the time that it jumped off the page at me, but it didn't mean anything to me. All of a sudden, it seemed like it was incredibly significant. What was significant about it is, though it's subtle, I never heard anybody in any of the religions I thought I knew about say that. I thought I was somewhat knowledgeable about religions of the world, Western and Eastern. I just had opinions about organized religion, that's all, drunken opinions. But we found that God doesn't make too hard terms. My grandmother's Pentecostal church never said that. If anything, they said just the opposite. They'd say, they call me, Well, hello, I hope you brought your guitar tonight. We're going to make a joyful noise. And they would say, Reverend Van Dyke, Brother Van Dyke would say, we are very sure that God makes hard terms on those who seek Him. Boy, God will not even hear your prayers unless you're baptized. And I don't mean sprinkled on the forehead like some Methodist. No, I'm talking about total submission, boy. That's why we got a tank of water for Christ up here. Come on up. Come on up, son. We're going to soak you down, pull you up, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus. Amen. Somebody get the boy a towel. And, I'm about 14 years old, I know my grandmother wouldn't let him drown her only grandson, but I just, she's a little bitty thing, and he's got big old fat guys, and I wasn't taking a chance, maybe she told him I touched myself, I don't know, but I mean, they could be sending my ass to Jesus for my own good, for all I know, so I know one thing, only thing I know right now is I'm not getting wet in this room tonight. I told him, I gotta go. Man, I'd love to be part of your thing, but I got brand new Levi's on, shrink to fit, you know what I'm saying? Like, I wouldn't be able to ride my bike home, so I'll be back sometime. I'm out of there. I could just imagine Brother Van Dyke saying the next day, I'll tell you what, I'm going to miss that boy's guitar playing. Thank God he don't have to abuse himself no more. And I'm out of there. But it wasn't just the Pentecostals. My girlfriend was Catholic. She had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, a bunch of other cons. to find out how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers were required to cleanse her soul of the various kinds of sins. Because the Catholics don't have sin, you know. They got them categorized, venial, cardinal, mortal. Some of them you don't even have to do them. If you think about them, expressway to hell. Like, you could burn in perdition for eternity for thinking about sin. That is not for me. So my friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew. He and his brother Sherm had to wear spit curls to school for some reason to please God. I thought, there's a loving God for you. And I went over to Michael's house for dinner one night. His mother says, Doug, welcome to our home. It's an honor to have you. Would you like to join us in some wine and challah? Some what? She said, would you like to join the family in some wine and challah? I said, well, I'll have some wine. I'm not much of a pastry eater, Mrs. Stein. And then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my. So by the time I got to AA, I'm like, okay, here's the line. All the religions of the world over on that side, I'll be over here making fun of you. And that's the guy that came to AA. But now I'm reading this chapter 4 that says, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. Maybe I'll seek him. I don't know if I will or not, but I'll go back to AA. And I went back, and I started going regularly. I started going 5, 6, 7 times a week. Different groups. In LA, there's about 3,000 meetings a week now, but at the time there were about 2,000, which is plenty. You could go to a different meeting every day of the year. And so I just went to a lot of different meetings all over the San Fernando Valley and Hollywood and the San Gabriel Valley. I just went to meetings for all over the place, mostly because I didn't want anybody to get to know me, and I wanted to find out about AA. So what happened is I got kind of a nice overview of AA. All kinds of different meetings and stuff. Some meetings I like, so I start going there a little more regularly, and I started taking bogus shifts. Some girl, I didn't raise my hand. I was raising my hand as new. Anybody under 30 days, Doug, alcoholic. And we have any visitors, any new people with us, new friends with less than 30 days, with Doug, alcoholic. So I just got tired of it. One day I didn't raise my hand, and some girl said to her friend, Doug's got 30 days. I thought, how the hell does she know my name? Doug, alcoholic. I was being arrogant. She mistook my arrogance for humility or something, and serenity, I don't know. But I got up and took a 30-day chip because I don't want her to look bad. And everybody went crazy. It's like, yay, Doug. I thought, oh, it's nothing, because it was nothing, you know. But now I got a sobriety date 30 days before my first bogus chip. So then I would start taking chips all over the place. And then sometimes 30 days didn't seem like enough, or, you know, so I go for 60 or 90. And, you know, I heard this girl say, and my sponsor said I can't have sex till I'm sober 6 months. So I took a 6-month chip over there. And I'd hate to get lucky and be like, how much time do you have? Oh, too bad. Come back when you have 6 months. No, right here, baby. I got, you know, it's like, now I couldn't have got lucky in a women's prison with a pocket full of pardons, but I told you, I'm a liar, you know. But what happened was I went to AA for 8 months. My first 8 months in AA, I didn't have a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't take the steps. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't have a commitment anywhere. I didn't believe in God, and I was drinking every day. Except for that, I had a pretty good program. My program was keep coming back. It's the only thing I did right in that first 8 months. But I came home from a meeting one night, and I had a bottle of whiskey, and I laid on the floor and drank whiskey till I passed out. And that's what I usually did. And I woke up about 3 a.m., and I turned off the TV, and I got my bottle, and I crawled on my hands and knees through the living room, through the hallway into the bedroom to go to bed, which is, some people would call it pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I just called it going to bed. But I got into my bedroom, and I stood up to get undressed, and as soon as I stood up, I fell. I fell on my knees, and I spilled whiskey all over the bed, and grabbed the bottle, and there's still some left, but most of it's in the bedspread. So I grabbed the bedspread and started sucking whiskey out of it, and I don't know, a voice in my head said, hey, man, that ain't right. You thirsty? There's whiskey in the bottle, man. I wouldn't say thirsty so much as frugal. You know, I waste my life, but I'm not letting whiskey evaporate in the bedspread overnight. And so I looked at what I was doing. Clearly, it's the actions of an alcoholic. That didn't surprise me. What surprised me was I didn't know what to do about it. I felt lost and alone and out of ideas, which is a horrible, it feels horrible, but it's a wonderful place to be if you're a practicing alcoholic who's considering sobriety. Because if I was out of ideas and I just looked for something that I heard somebody say and I said, God, if you're there, please help me. I didn't think anybody was listening. I don't even know for sure if I knew it was a prayer. But I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I went to bed and I went to sleep. And over the next couple of weeks, literally 14 days, the next day I went into my neighborhood liquor store. Only one of three people could be behind that counter night or day. They all know what I drink. All they need to know is pint or half pint. But there's a guy from AA behind the counter, this guy Ralph. I said, what are you doing here? He said, no, what are you doing here? I just came to get some smoke. So I got my cigarettes and I went someplace else and got a bottle. But then I'm in the Vaughn's Market in the liquor department, reach up for a bottle. Somebody from AA is pushing a cart towards me. Yeah, one day at a time. Keep it simple. It's a beautiful life. So I had to walk all over. It seemed like she followed me around with a damn cart. So I had to go someplace else and get a bottle. I'm in a restaurant in Burbank. I'm across the street from NBC. I went over there to have lunch and start to order a margarita. The waitress is somebody I know from AA. These kind of things are happening to me every day. And it didn't keep me from drinking. But after a while, you can't not notice them. On the 14th day after that prayer, I'm on the way to work, 6:30 in the morning, and I just killed a half pint of Bushmills. And I don't keep empty bottles in the car, they're illegal and useless. So I roll down the window and I toss this bottle just as a guy from AA is driving towards me at 6:30 a.m. He saw me and he waved and I threw a bottle in front of his car. Bing, the bang, bang, bang. And I saw him go, whoa, when he went by. And I thought, where the hell are these people coming from? Where are they coming from? It's like those stupid miracles people talk about in the meetings. And I realized that I had been on my knees and said, God, if you're there, please help me. And every day since then, these little pain in the ass God jokes, or miracles if you prefer, or coincidences, had been happening. It shocked me. I pulled the car over the side of the road and I sat there and I came to believe. I remembered that I'd been on my knees asking God for help and I got the help. You told me that would happen. Ask God for help and the help will come. But I thought it was like a parable or a metaphor or something. And I came to believe. I sat there in that car on the way to work that morning and I came to believe that a power greater than myself existed and would restore me to sanity. And then I started the car and I started. It's funny, I felt so safe. I felt like I could let go of the steering wheel. I really felt like that. I didn't do it. I'm glad. I'm happy to report because you'd have a different speaker tonight. But I got to work and I went and told the people in my home group later, I've been lying to you. Because by then I was used to going to meetings irregularly at the San Fernando group. So I've been lying. Some people knew. Some people knew I'd been lying. Some people didn't. But I was humble enough to say, I've been lying to you. And here's what happened. I had this experience. I had this spiritual experience. This guy Page is sober about 3.5 years. He said, well, good. I hope that keeps you sober, Doug. And I said, well, I don't know if you understood what I said, but I had the major Bill Wilson white light spiritual experience, so I think I'm good. He said, great, man. I hope that works for you. Sage, look, I don't know if you're listening, but I had the major Bill Wilson white light spiritual awakening in my car on the way to work today. I think I'm going to be okay. He said, great, good. I hope you are. I said, look, I'm sorry about you and your educational variety, you know, but I had like the real deal. And he said, oh, you had the real deal. Bill Wilson had the educational variety. He had a spiritual experience at Winchester Cathedral 17 years before his last drink. And it took him 17 years to realize what he had. You came in here and we told you all about our experiences. That's the educational variety. And when you finally realize what happened and tried it, it worked. That white light you thought you saw was your head coming out of your ass. So, they'll explain stuff to you, you know, if you let them. So I started doing stuff around AA. They were reupholstering chairs. Yeah, let me help you. They were putting new paneling up on the walls. Yeah, they needed some signs. Yeah, let me help you with that. They needed some people to play at a Christmas party. Yeah, me and this other guys put together a little AA band and played some stuff. And I started getting involved in AA. I would be elected secretary of a little meeting, you know, and that's great. Because then when you're about 60 or 90 days sober and you get elected secretary of a meeting, you think you're the president of AA. It can be kind of good for your humility, you know, when you get slapped down by people. This is not your meeting. This is the Saturday 1:30 meeting. But I started getting involved, and I started taking these steps. When I was 2 years sober, I really started getting seriously into making my amends. I didn't quite know how to go about it for a while. I did. I was dragging my feet and saying I didn't know how to go about it. But I was at my daughter's high school graduation, and I said to my dad, I owed him some money. I borrowed a lot of money, pay him back, borrow some more, pay him back, but not pay him all the way back, just give him some money, you know. So I knew I was in arrears, and I figured it was somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000. So I was going to save up $3,000, and then, hey, Dad, you know that money I owe you? Ba-boom. But I didn't. I know a lot of people that were going to do that, but I know a lot of people who actually did start making payments on debts. So I said to my dad, look, I owe you a lot of money, and I want to pay it back. He said, don't worry about it. Look at you. You know what I mean? I was 2 years sober at the time. Look at you. Everything I wanted you to be, everything your mother and I wanted for you, you are. You know, you're a good son. You're a good father. You're a good husband. You're a good neighbor. You're a good employee. That's all we ever wanted, was for you to be a good man. I said, yeah, don't worry about that money. I don't want it. I don't need it. I said, that's fine for you, but you know about the 12 steps? He said, yeah. I said, well, the ninth step says we made amends for harms that we caused. And I think borrowing money and not paying it back is a harm. So I want to pay you this money. He said, don't worry about it. I said, I'm not worried about it, but I may not stay sober if I don't pay you this money back. Oh. He said, I didn't know. Okay, well, I said, you know how much I owe you? And he said, no, I don't, but I got it in the computer. I don't want it, I don't need it, but you know, I don't want to break a nail on that delete button or anything. So he had it. He had it stored, and he printed it out. And he sent it to me. And the balance was a little over $7,200. So I'm glad I didn't save up that $3,000. Here's your money, Dad. Well, I appreciate the effort. You're a little short, but that's good. So I started sending him a check. Every Friday, I would send him a check, whatever I could afford. There was no payment schedule set up, and I didn't even keep track of how much I owed, because I knew he would. So I would send every check. Friday, I'd send him a check, $20, $30, sometimes $50, sometimes $100, whatever I could afford that week, and a note, because I had heard Sharon B, say that that's what she had done with her dad. So I sent him a check and a note every Friday. And after about 3 years, he called me and he said, hey, I just got your check. I said, is there a problem with it? No, no, it's never a problem. He said, but you know how much you owe me? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, $32. I said, are you sure? He said, you know I am. And I did. I knew. I knew I owed him less than $1,000 at that point, but I didn't really know. I was surprised, $32. So we met for dinner, and I gave him his check, and he gave me a little closeout statement, everything I paid back, you know, right down to the penny, the $32, zeroed it out, and I let him pay for dinner. Because every time I had dinner with my dad, I would say, let me get this, Dad. And he'd say, no, it's a father's job to feed his family. I go, come on, let me get it. I'm a grown man. I'm not your little kid. No, it's a father's job to feed his family. I'll get the check. And sometimes I'd rush around, find the waitress, and give her my card and hope it was good, you know. But once I got this debt paid off, once I got loose from that bondage of self, that burden I had been carrying, oh my God, Dad, let me buy dinner. I owe you all this money. Once I got free of that, I could hear him say, it's a father's job to feed his family. That's what he thought he was supposed to do, and I would try to deprive him of it. And so I never paid for another meal as long as my dad was alive, unless I was taking him out for his birthday or something. But when he died, geez, 18 years ago, and I was helping my mom go through his file cabinet to find some financial things that she needed to find. And I found this file that said Doug, and it was a fat file, and I pulled it out. When I opened it up, all these notes fell out. It was like just little post-its and pieces of stationery, and, you know, I knew what it was immediately, and I was shocked. I didn't know this. They didn't seem savable to me. I appreciated it, but I was shocked. I said to my mother, did you know he saved all these notes? She said, oh, yeah. He cherished those notes. He cherished them. She said, your check would come. He'd come in from the mailbox, and he'd open the envelope, and he'd put the check in his pocket, and he would read me the note and smile, put it down on the table, take last week's note, and put it in the file cabinet. And the note would stay on the table all week long. Sometimes he'd come home from work, and he was tired, and it was a hard day, and he'd pick up the note and read it and smile. She said, one time I said to him, You know, Doug sure loves you. He said, I know that. I got it in his own handwriting. And so I believe that every step, every one of these 12 steps comes with a personal gift from God. And sometimes it's small and you don't even really notice it. And sometimes it's huge, like a note from the grave, a message from the grave saying, I love you, I respect you. When my dad was dying, he gathered the whole family around and he said goodbye to everybody, and he was about ready to pass, you know. And I said to him, took his hand, I said, Dad, everything that's good about me I got from you. He said, that's not true. I said, I think it is. You're the one that showed me how to be a man, how to be a neighbor, how to be a father, how to be a son, how to be a husband. He said, well, you have AA. And that's exactly the truth. All the things that my dad wanted to teach me, the man that he wanted to make me into, I knew how to do, I just couldn't do until I met you. And you were able to show me how to implement those principles, how to put him above defects, how to be a man. I got that from you, and my father left this world knowing that. And I thank you for that.